Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. As is traditional, as we used to say in the party, there are two guests today. Quinn Slobodian continues his exploration of the history, theory, and practice of neoliberalism with a look at an underappreciated contributor to the movement, the white supremacist Peter Brimelow. And Derek Seidman looks at the ruling class of Alabama, which is passionately fighting the UAW's effort to organize auto plants in the state. Much of the analysis of neoliberalism as an intellectual formation and a political movement has focused on high-profile economists, mostly university-based, like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman. Hayek was the force behind the Mont Pelerin Society, known to connoisseurs as the MPS, which held its founding conference at the base of that Swiss mountain in 1947. It continues today, headquartered in a considerably less romantic setting, Lubbock, Texas, gathering together economists, historians, philosophers, journalists, and business leaders to pursue the society's goal of insulating markets and capitalists from what they see as malign political interference. That is, anything that looks like socialism or social democracy. They are never so naive as to believe that markets are spontaneous natural formations. They have to be created and nurtured through political means. One of the leading contemporary writers on this topic is the historian Quinn Slobodian, a professor of international history at Boston University, who's becoming a frequent Behind the News guest. His book, Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism, published in 2018 by Harvard University Press, is an illuminating intellectual and organizational history of the doctrine. His most recent book, Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, just out in paperback from Metropolitan, is a chronicle of the attempts by free marketeers to carve out safe spaces for a pure capitalism in what they see as a hostile world, enclaves like tax havens and special economic zones. These bring a geographic dimension to the neoliberal dream of insulating the market from bad interventions like regulation and taxes. Quinn has just published an article in the Journal of American Studies, which I'm sorry to say isn't widely available, on an interesting but fundamentally vile character named Peter Brimelow, who is one of the links between neoliberalism and, frankly, white supremacist politics. Brimelow has had a long career as a financial journalist, writing for Barron's, Forbes, and Fortune, among others. He's also the founder of a nativist white supremacist website called VDare, named after Virginia Dare, thought to be the first white child born in what later would become the United States. Brimelow is an interesting case study in himself, but also for his relations with other parts of the right and their sometimes conflicting views of immigration. Quinn Slobodian. Now, your general point that analyses of the emergence of the newest new right, or alt-right, which really has a lot in common with the old right, but let's leave that aside, doesn't really engage much with its relationship to capitalism. As you point out, violates Max Horkheimer's dictum, whoever is not willing to talk about capitalism should also keep quiet about fascism. What does that failure to engage with capitalism miss, and why do you suppose this has been happening? My guess is that many of the critiques are written by liberals who are comfortable with capitalism and would prefer to look at identity, but what are your thoughts on this?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that there's a strong desire in American political life that we've been seeing a lot recently to see problems in the political consensus as coming somehow from outside. There's somehow attractions to some exotic political ideology or, you know, some imported, whether German, Muslim, or Chinese, depending on which decade of the 20th and 21st century we're in.
Don't forget the Russians.
Yeah, the Russians. But the desire, I feel like, especially post-2016, to narrate the problem of the far right as a kind of a cultural question was, in that case, maybe an import happening inside of the United States. I feel like there was some sense that there was some evil stuff happening in the heartland that was seeping into the cities and now was coming in to storm the citadels of orderliness and wealth creation in the cities. So there was this desire, I think, to cast the problem of the far right as a barbarian at the gates and an inability, I think, to see it as having any kind of economic rationality, except for the one which we did hear quite often, which was a kind of a backlash or an anger at the uneven distribution of the era of globalization. But to see it as coming from sort of within the citadel, so to speak, from the heights of places like Wall Street, which my article, I think, shows pretty directly, was somehow a category error. Why would people who were already prospering or wealthy from the system be interested in even a further radicalization or transformation of the system. It broke the dialectical brain, I think, of many of the thinking classes in the United States.
Relatedly, a lot of people thought of Trump as some sort of creature of Putin, even though Trump, to me, seems, you know, very, very much an American character, very homegrown, a huckster, nativist, you know, just lots of things that have characterized American politics for a long time. But yeah, this impulse to see things as imports from abroad rather than something that's homegrown is pretty pervasive.
Either that, or I think there's also a willingness to see parts of capitalist culture as being excessive, immoderate. So post-2008, there was a lot of that. Let's rein in the excesses of capitalism. Let's get more corporate social responsibility. Let's regulate the outer fringes of casino capitalism. And I think people could look back at the Trump lifestyle of the 1980s and see something negative about it. But they wouldn't, I think, categorize that as far right, right? I mean, I think it would be seen as immoderate, breaking some sort of WASP principles of self-governance, but not right-wing. Seeing capitalism as a self-right-wing is like an intrinsic problem for America's ideology.
Okay, so your case study is Peter Brimelow. Probably not a household name for most people. I've been following him for decades, but, you know, I think a lot of people don't really know who he is. So who is he? Where did he come from? And what's his importance?
So he came up a lot if you were reading profiles of the emerging kind of proselytizers of the alt-right around 2017, 2018, as someone who was a real forerunner of violent nativism and someone who was helping to bring back race science. He was described with some frequency as a white nationalist in the press to the point that he actually sued the New York Times and lost at his description as a white nationalist. He was being placed alongside neo-Nazis and sort of creatures of the internet. Rarely was his background mentioned. And my whole article is basically just to say, like, look, this guy is not some basement dwelling like freak of the internet. This guy was a financial journalist for decades and decades. He worked for Forbes, Fortune, the Financial Post in Canada, and was widely read and continues to be well-placed inside of the opinion-making circles in the United States. He was famously a guest at Larry Kudlow's house in 2018, and as the New York Times reported, was employed by Fox and had a kind of a direct advisory role to Rupert Murdoch around the same time. So what I did was I walked through his career as someone who was working to act as a stockbroker whisperer, supposedly giving people the edge on where the market was going and how it was changing. But then someone who was also at the same time quite active in neoliberal intellectual networks. So he was speaking at the Mont Pelerin Society. He was hanging out with Julian Simon and Charles Murray and going to events at the various think tanks that they all frequent. And in the process, he was sort of groping his way towards what became his open racial hierarchy and opposition to immigration by non-white people, which led to the publication in 1994 of his most well-known book, Alien Nation, which immigration historians look at it and they're like, wow, this is when the tone really changed in American discourse, when it was a sort of gloves off, mask off moment where race came back into the discussion. And absolute statements against people of certain backgrounds as being undesirable became mainstreamed in a serious way. This was published on a big trade press. It was reviewed all across the country. He followed that up by founding a website called VDare in 1999, which is named after Virginia Dare, who was the first white girl born in North America. And since then, he's been seen as a trailblazer for mainstreaming language that had been previously only heard on the fringes. I actually got an email after publishing this article by a woman who used to be in the alt-right, very active in those circles, and she sort of said, yeah, this is right. This is the guy we all look to as the person who had been there forever, the old head involved in American Renaissance and things like that. So he had a biography of him, I think, is sort of long overdue.
You say in the article that Thatcherite intellectuals had their own version of a cultural turn, with social scientists like Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein concocting theories linking race, intelligence, and economic capacity, and then the popularization of Asian values in Western analysts' analysis of Asian economic success. Yeah, could you talk a bit about that cultural turn, which is usually applied to the left?
Absolutely. one of my sort of bugbears is the way that a lot of people continue to conflate neoliberalism as economism and think that neoliberal theory is just about understanding humans as purely rational actors, just maximizing and thinking only in terms of prices. But if you look at the wide-ranging intellectual discussions around the Mont Pelerin Society and then conservative think tanks that are connected to them, Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, et cetera, Institute of Economic Affairs in London, you see they're always talking about much more wide-ranging topics. They're talking about sociology, anthropology, religion, clearly. And in the 90s, with the publication of The Bell Curve by Murray and Herrnstein, psychology really came back onto the agenda, and IQ in particular became a very attractive way of creating an ordinal ranking and a hierarchy of how people could contribute to the market. The focus still remained market competition, but to get a fuller sense of what Rimelow called the meta market, you needed to range into all of these adjacent disciplines, from sociobiology to race science and genomics. In the 90s, this became important because for some people, there was a real fear that the West was losing its edge to especially East Asian competitors from Japan, Singapore. Taiwan seemed to be, you know, doing better in terms of productivity, doing better in terms of labor discipline, suppressing these new pernicious ideologies of environmentalism, feminism, civil rights. So some attention to like the questions of Confucian values became very mainstream in the 90s. And for me, you can't understand the mutations of neoliberalism and then by extension, the mutations of far-right thought without seeing how ideas of market competition were really being blended together with ideas of human difference and a hierarchy of human ability. And that's really how a lot of these topics of nativism and anti-immigrationism were made palatable to a New York Times reading audience. One of the things I was really amazed at being, you know, not quite old enough to remember this, is that in 1984 and for the next several years, the Wall Street Journal was literally publishing a call for open borders every 4th of July. You probably remember this. You probably leafed through the journal at the time, but I did not know that. I didn't know that they were calling for the thing which now is described as the demand of the Democratic Party, right, with no justifiable basis. So this turn in mainstream conservatism in the U.S. towards anti-immigrationism, hard borders, which has happened over the last 25 years, needs to be told with the weaving together of these different social scientific threads.
We talked about via email the other day about the former Fortune magazine columnist Daniel Seligman, who frankly like ranked the races in a hierarchy of IQs. This Fortune magazine is not like, you know, some marginal publication, some zine published by a Nazi youth in Kansas. It was circulating in right-wing circles as far back as the 80s, this kind of racialized hierarchy in which the West was not necessarily at top.
No, absolutely not. It's all part of something that sociologists who had their eye on the ball have noticed, which is since the 90s or so, the social construction of race idea had won that, you know, Ruth Benedict and Franz Boas had defeated the physical anthropologists. And now we all knew that race was just a construct and it could be undone if it could be done, has been really on the back foot. And the rise of genomics, the mapping of the human genome, the rise of the prestige of neuroscience, the popularity of things like home DNA kits like 23andMe has meant that race is really back since the 1990s. And if it's back in the science pages and people are saying, no, we can identify diseases are associated with different genetic subpopulations, and maybe then you can profile for different vulnerabilities, blah, 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 then it can be sort of made available for political means too. And the example of Murray and Herrnstein is just perfect because they were able to use this sort of backdoor of supposed respectability of social science as argued in tables and graphs to smuggle in like a directly political argument and make it sugar the pill for the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who bought that book, The Bell Curve, and kept it on bestseller lists for almost an entire year. So I think it can't be underestimated. And this is another reason why I think the liberal response of trusting the science is naive, because as any other good science studies person will tell you, the science doesn't only say one thing. Facts are, you know, created through political narratives. And the right has been trusting their own version of science very much, I think, in their construction of an alternative future for us in the last 30 years.
It's interesting that he seems to think that cultural explanations of the defects of the black population, which are, of course, self-evident and don't need to be proved, evade a real racial determinism. And only Brimelow and the likes of him have the courage to name the real problem, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found a lot of this was like nauseating, but maybe just because it was so personal that I found it quite disgusting is when Brimelow went after Dinesh D'Souza, of all people, right? Because Dinesh D'Souza was talking about the end of racism, saying these are cultural traits, deficiencies can be sequestered or quarantined or whatever, educated away. And he pointed to the example of his daughter, who was of, you know, mixed racial heritage, and said, you can't say what race she is. And Brimelow, in his review of D'Souza in the National Review, said, yes, you can. She is this. And he named her race. He said, and he named her name even and said, you know, she is a Euro-Asian dot, dot, dot. We have to not be afraid of breaking this taboo if we're going to start telling the truth in this country. And you can see these moments like that, even if it's just in a review in the back pages of National Review, as moving the Overton window, right? Like cracking open a kind of a discussion that had been previously not allowed in respectable, quote unquote, circles. And the fact that the new position on the right is if you're squeamish about saying racial differences are genetic, then you're being an intellectual coward is like a pretty extreme leap. But I think that by now, even then, Trump is, I think, absorbing and repeating a lot of these similar kind of themes. We are sort of careening towards that position.
I'm speaking with Quinn Slobodian, a historian of neoliberalism. Brimelow has spent his professional life as a journalist, and he did a lot of covering of the transformation of capitalism in the 1980s. What did that do to his political evolution?
Yeah, I mean, the Montpelier Society was always designed to include both academics and policymakers and journalists. The idea was, in Hayek's original formulation, that you needed to actually not only target politicians, but the so-called secondhand dealers in ideas. So for him, journalists were really important because they spoke to, even in a dumbed down manner, you know, a much broader audience than an academic ever could. So from the beginning, people like John Davenport and Chamberlain were very active. Brimelow is a perfect case of this because when he was writing for Forbes and Fortune, his main big stories were interviews with Milton Friedman, Peter Bauer, Thomas Sowell, Lawrence White, Friedrich Hayek. So he was doing exactly what Hayek hoped to do. In fact, after I published this letter, a friend of mine posted a great letter that he had from Michael Walker, who ran the Fraser Institute, a sort of storied neoliberal think tank in Vancouver, in which Brimelow actually is introduced to Hayek. And Walker says, hey, Brimelow is this libertarian who would like to speak to you to get your ideas about constitutional constraints on liberal societies into print. Part of it was prestige. You know, I think he, as a journalist, is sort of raised the niveau of his work a bit to be citing these heavyweight luminaries. But I think he also was in the era of like smash and grab capitalism. And, you know, you've written about this yourself a bit, how we can't understand the right without understanding the total disruption of the corporate landscape of the 1980s and the kind of social Darwinist ethos of hostile takeovers and leverage buyouts left an impression on him, too, as being a sign of a gloves off frankness or bluntness, which was like necessary to win. If you think about the Tea Party being launched from the floor of the Chicago Stock Exchange by someone from this same background, someone who's talking sort of about financial journalism, but actually he's helping to launch a grassroots social movement of resentment by one group of society against the other. There's a way that if you wholeheartedly import the dynamic of the trading floor into politics, there will be blood on the streets. And, you know, as Aaron Rothschild said, that's the best time to invest.
His relationship with Julian Simon was an important part of his evolution as well. Could you say something about Simon and then what Brimelow's reaction to him, how it shaped his thought?
Julian Simon is, I think, a very unappreciated figure in basically two extremely important policy fields as a neoliberal economist. One is climate policy and the other is immigration policy. Troy Vitezzi has written a really good intellectual biography of him in an article. I think it's the best one that exists, describing how Simon won this famous bet with Paul Ehrlich that a certain basket of commodities would actually become cheaper within a certain period of time and getting more expensive, which really went against the neo-Malthusian ethos of the 1970s, the era of limits to growth and so on. Julian Simon wrote a book about humans called The Ultimate Resource, saying basically we will always be able to innovate and synthesize our way out of bottlenecks. So in short, we don't have to worry about the finitude of natural resources. We're always going to be able to come up with something new. And he has in some ways been proven wrong, of course, with disastrous effects for the planet. But this is still like the lodestar for people advising Trump, like Stephen Moore cites Julian Simon. He's considered now just the man telling the truth about the infinite nature of the world's resources in the hands of humans. But at the same time, he was also somewhat relatedly a big advocate of liberalizing immigration policy. So if humans were the ultimate resource, then they should also be encouraged to immigrate. Many of the people in the kind of Wall Street Journal open borders phase would call on Simon as an authority, as someone who was supporting their arguments. So for Brimelow, it became like the most important antagonist to try to defeat Julian Simon, who he described as having met as a fellow libertarian ideologue, quote unquote. He was like the most worthy adversary. The kind of twist that I include in the article is that Simon actually wasn't calling for open borders either. He was also saying that we need to rank incoming populations in terms of their skills, in short, their human capital. And this is actually was itself an affront to the idea of birthright citizenship, you know, that had long been normal in the United States. It was so-called designer immigration that was becoming popular at the time. Ben Wattenberg was also promoting this. Fukuyama was promoting this. It's, I think, a time when the whole immigration discussion was tacking right, and the less far-right version was we need to do a selection procedure of people with higher skills, move to more points-based system as they have in Canada and elsewhere. And then the further right one of those is we don't need to do that because we have the shorthand of these races are never going to have high skills anyway, so we can just keep them out in the first place.
And then we can import cheaply made goods from these inferior countries.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, I think, the other fallacy I was trying to undercut was that, you know, the far right is always a throwback to the 1930s in the sense that they want to build walls around the national territory, move towards something like self-sufficiency or autarky, and thereby, you know, fracture the world economy into these sealed trading blocks. That's in most cases not true, in almost all cases not true. The far right is more of its own alter globalization ethos, right? They want to be able to keep people out and keep the goods flowing and keep the money flowing. So this idea of full withdrawal, which I think sometimes is also the lazy assumption about what the U.S. far right might be interested in, is true in only the more marginal cases and not of the more prominent figures like Brimelow.
Did they ever investigate who would be the nannies and gardeners under this policy?
Poor whites, I guess. Brimelow was British. I don't know if I mentioned that. You know, so he was quite comfortable with the idea. You know, he would have grown up in an England that was still much whiter than it is today, in which menial tasks were done by, you know, a lower class of ethnically similar but economically different population. And so I guess that that's what he had in mind.
He once suggested, I guess in the late 80s, that immigration to North America be limited to WASPs, which people, I think even his editor read this as a joke, but it sort of illustrates the way in which the far right uses humor to make these over-the-top policy proposals that they actually are quite serious about.
Yeah, you could call it humor. It's also just kind of like shock, right? I mean, it was a polemic to the level that his editor assumed that it was humor. They assumed that this was intended as a joke. But it wasn't. So I think that ability to use over the top provocations is could be a kind of humor, but it's also just a good way of building publicity and attention, right? I mean, I think it's all of those small acts of overstepping what are considered the boundaries of polite behavior is what led so many of us to be talking about the alt-right in 2017, right? It wasn't clear that they actually had that much political power, but they had done a series of genuinely shocking things on their marches, in their chants, in their publications, in their gatherings, that they gamed the kind of media landscape, I think, in a way that served their own purposes. And it remains, I think, a dilemma about how you write about and talk about and cover these kind of fringe attacks from the margins without giving them more oxygen we're not as naive and stupid as that editor was anymore. But one still wonders about if it's about making new ideas available, whether or not even discussing them, printing, writing articles about them isn't kind of doing that service as well.
He had a class analysis of why the U.S. would embrace suicidal immigration policies, a new class. Now, who is this new class and why would they do such a thing?
In its essence, it's quite similar to the kind of great replacement argument or other versions of ideas about weaponizing immigrants to produce bodies of new voters that can then keep the existing cathedral, as Minch's Moldbug would call them, in power. So he called them the new class, drawing on Irving Kristol and others, meaning there was an opinion-making elite in the world of journalism, academia, government, that would find it in their best interest to extend the welcoming hand, so to speak, to immigrants, because those immigrants would then reward them with political support and legitimacy, and thus the heartland middle class would be ever more facing competition through immigrants and through foreign lifestyles. But these could be seamlessly embraced and picked up by the already kind of deracinated inhabitants of the enclaves of the coasts and just turned into a pleasant multicultural active consumption because they wouldn't actually have to face the direct economic competition.
You write about a mutant socialism that trades in chromatic signs and skin tones, a socialism of pigmentation, but not material distribution. That sounded like some arguments you hear from the class first quarters of the left.
I can't remember if it made it into the final article, but at some point I did have a footnote there to Nancy Fraser and her idea of progressive neoliberalism, because it is not so different, I think. The argument that he's making is that an economically maldistributive policy is accepted and then compensated for by a kind of redistribution of some of the spoils to a very small tokenistic symbolic minority elite, which then are able to present themselves as evidence of the success of the whole model. So it's about then this game of just semiotic markers of difference and diversity rather than or any attempt to address actual inequality at an economic. I think it's unquestionable that there is a certain convergence of critiques from the left and the right on that specific point. And someone like Sarah Wagenknecht in Germany right now has created a new political party just to capitalize on the similarities of those two critiques, which rely on, for one thing, privileging the nation as the place where redistribution and social justice should be realized. So rarely in these arguments is it suggested that it could be an act of economic redistribution in a global sense if you actually allow people to come in, given that remittances are actually probably cynically but true the most effective form of foreign aid. It also suggests that there is literally no improvement or contribution made by confrontation, absorption, engagement with people from different backgrounds, cultures, languages. I mean, all of the ways that I think you and I would agree the diversity of and the density of immigrant populations makes cities worthwhile and beautiful, they have to bracket that away and say it's worthless.
The likes of Brimelow make the argument that ethnic homogeneity lowers transaction costs and so is economically efficient. How is that?
It's a really interesting moment in the 1990s because there's this big interest in something called the New Institutional Economics, also not a household name, but someone named Douglas T. North wins the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics because of this contribution. He and many of the people who worked in this field were actually more like historians than economists. And the question they were really asking was, why did the West get rich and the rest of the world didn't? And one of the arguments that they ended up making, you know, along with many other arguments about the rule of law and supporting basic research and blah, 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 was that actually having ethnically homogeneous populations ends up reducing transaction costs. There's more trust, more ability to have economic exchange within an in-group. Therefore, you know, in a distorted way, you can use that as an argument to defend the restriction of immigration to people who are from a different group, because you're going to say, oh, we're going to actually be harming ourselves economically if people who don't trust each other, who don't, maybe don't speak each other's language and so on. Interestingly, around the same time, some social scientist, Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone, also wrote a book that kind of came to a similar conclusion, but direction, saying that ethnic homogeneity actually might be a precondition for a more socialist, social democratic country. So he made the same argument, but for different reasons. And it's just another one of the ways that like economics ceased to be a science of you know, numbers and prices, if it ever was, and I was always expanding and doing these Freakonomic type investigations, which inevitably found their way into political ideologies.
Finally, one danger of this sort of ethno-nationalist nativist politics is that the center-left parties often adopt weaker, but still nasty versions of it. Is there any way out of this vicious cycle?
It's a good question. I mean, people at the time tried to counter what he was saying by trying to use the economic logic in a different direction. So there's a wonderful example that's not in here, but it will be in the longer book, of which this will be a chapter, where Francis Fukuyama ends up sort of locking horns with William F. Buckley and Brimelow over this statement that Patrick Buchanan made that was in defense of restrictions, saying that he thought that it's unquestionable, Buchanan said, that if you let in a million people from Liverpool, they would assimilate more easily than a million Zulus, quote unquote. And Buckley and Brimelow basically, you know, this is a great moment of sort of shock jock provocation, pushing the envelope. Buckley and Brimelow came to his defense and said, of course, this is right. How foolish. Also, in making snide comments like, and then we'd have to be paying public school teachers to teach them in Zulu because now everybody gets their own language instruction. And Fukuyama and someone else whose name I forget right now had a response, which was basically like, well, but what if those Zulus were computer scientists and the people from Liverpool were football hooligans? Then maybe that would be different. So it tried to flip the economistic logic on its head and defend people of different racial backgrounds because they might have themselves superior human capital abilities. And I think that's often the mainstream democratic response, would be to sort of say, we also believe in a bottom line of improving the economic chances of the United States, and which inputs do we want that will actually help us on that? That, I think, is a bad way of going about it, because you've kind of conceded the point. You've left that sitting there. I think you can do the kind of internationalist move by saying that there's no particular reason why the expectations and rights of people in this country should be more meaningful or have more validity than people elsewhere. But that's probably not a super productive political strategy, given we still are organized into national democracies. So I think it's just, more than anything, the specific ways that they make the argument throughout the book are based on distortions, wild exaggerations, and fallacies, which can be sort of countered simply by everyday acts of coexistence. I think the same way that, you know, I spent a lot of time in Berlin, and for those people who said that Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews, for example, would never be able to live in the same place. I mean, parts of Berlin have been counterexamples to that for decades and decades. So without announcing themselves, I think just by living as friends with, as lovers of people from all these different parts of the world, then we can enact the obvious counterargument to their nonsense.
That was Quinn Slobodian, a professor of international history at Boston University and author of The Ethno-Economy, Peter Brimelow and the Capitalism of the Far Right, an article in the latest issue of the Journal of American Studies. His book, Crack Up Capitalism, is just out in paperback from Metropolitan. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of We Are All Bourgeois Now by the Marxist Britpop band McCarthy. Free to Choose is a phrase made famous by Milton Friedman, specifically because of a book he co-wrote with his wife, Rose Friedman, by that title, that was accompanied by a 10-part series on PBS. Broadcast in 1980, it was something of a milestone in popularizing the Mont Pelerin agenda, a task Milton Friedman was quite accomplished at. Next, the Alabama ruling class. The United Auto Workers, fresh from an organizing victory at a VW plant in Tennessee, is moving deeper into the South. From May 13th to 17th, 5,000 workers at a Mercedes plant in Vance, Alabama, will vote on whether they want the UAW to represent them. The union is also making inroads at a Hyundai plant in Montgomery, though things aren't quite so far along there. Business elites always oppose unions, but the Alabama elite does so with a special passion, since unions challenge an entire social order in the region, one that traces its roots to the pre-Civil War South, a history that Carrie Lee Merritt talked about on this show a couple of weeks ago. My next guest, Derek Seidman, has looked into that business elite, one that is unusually intertwined with the state's political class. Yes, that's true everywhere, but it seems particularly intimate in Alabama. Derek Seidman is a researcher and writer who contributes regularly to Little Sis, a group that studies networks of power, and to Truthout, where he's published two articles about the Alabama issue. Derek Seidman. I spent a lot of time thinking about the national ruling class, which, in the case of the United States, is to some degree the international ruling class, but I don't really think much about regional state elites in the same way. So before we started recording, you said you'd never seen anything quite like the Alabama ruling class. Tell us about how it stacks up in the hierarchy of ruling elites around the U.S.
I've researched a lot of state-level corporate power structures. There's always a lot of revolving doors and closeness between elected officials and corporations, but I think that Alabama really tops the list of what I've looked at. This all comes in the context of some research that I started doing into a group called the Business Council of Alabama. It's basically been sort of coordinating the statewide anti-union effort against auto workers that are attempting to unionize. It's a business association that it sort of, you know, represents generalized statewide corporate interests in Alabama. It's affiliated with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So on the surface, it looks like a traditional business lobby group pushing a traditional corporate agenda, fighting things like minimum wage increases and pushing for so-called workforce development, things like that. On a deeper level, it's really sort of a vehicle or nexus for coordinated project of maintaining ruling class power within Alabama. It has a wider board of directors made up of 135 members. It's almost entirely different corporations, and that includes Toyota and Mercedes and Honda. But its top governing leadership is a much smaller group, and that's made up of the state's, you know, most powerful corporations, ranging from Alabama's biggest bank to its biggest electric utility to its biggest healthcare company. And the state's only billionaire, Jimmy Rain, his corporation is also represented in the top leadership of the BCA.
Yeah, I was struck that when you said that they only have one billionaire. I knew Alabama was poor, but I didn't know they were that poor.
Jimmy Rain, the only billionaire in Alabama, his company, it's called Great Southern Wood Preserving. They're well known for this product called Yellow Wood. It's a wood product that's sold all over the country, Home Depot. You know, one of his top guys is the first vice chairman in the Business Council of Alabama. It really has like an enormous influence operation. I mean, Governor Kay Ivey of Alabama is really in the pocket of this business association. The overwhelming majority of her top donors come from its network. Katie Britt, a bungled alternative State of the Union fame, you know, a lot of people aren't aware that before she became the U.S. Senator from Alabama, along with Tommy Tuberville, she was the CEO and president of the Business Council of Alabama. That's what she did before becoming the senator. This is a group that's really, really used to having unchallenged class power in the state, and they view the UAW's union drive as a major threat.
Yeah, before we get to that, I'm just wondering, I don't know if you've looked into this, but there must be some kind of cultural conflict between the good old boys of Alabama and big companies like Mercedes. Do you notice anything along those lines?
The good old boys of Alabama, as you say, they're probably a lot more hostile to unions than the big multinational auto companies. Certainly there's, you know, as we know by a lot of the great reporting that's been done, you know, by really fantastic reporters from the labor left press like Luis Feliz Leon from Labor Notes and Alex Press from Jacobin and so on. There's a lot of pushback from the auto companies to unionization, a lot of anti-union tactics that are happening there. You know, you have this sort of old entrenched corporate and conservative power in Alabama that has a sense of their sort of entrenched class power in the state. And they really see unionization as not just like a discrete thing that might happen that they don't want, but as sort of like an existential threat to their deep, long rule in the state. That's something that really struck me, the sort of fierceness which the Alabama ruling class, and as well as other ruling classes. I mean, you know, there was a joint statement that was put out by six Southern governors opposing the UAW union drive. I mean, they really, really see this as a categorical threat to their rule.
Yeah, I mean, it really threatens a whole power structure that goes back before 1865. They're defending a very old order. The UAW now, let's talk about them. They're on the march now down south, fresh from a victory at a VW plant in Tennessee. They're moving on to two targets in Alabama. What's the situation? And I'm guessing that Governor Kay Ivey's comment that it's a corrupt, shifty, and dangerous leech sort of sets the tone for the reaction, right?
Yeah. As you know, I think it's next week, starting on May 13th, the UAW is going to be voting in the Mercedes-Benz plant in Vance, Alabama. My sense is that they're going to win, though I guess don't hold me to that. But it seems like they got a lot of momentum. The Business Council of Alabama's campaign against auto worker unionization, it's been really intense. I mean, they've been publishing op-eds in newspapers. They've been amplifying different politicians who are denouncing the UAW. They started a website. It's called Alabama Strong. That's been sort of a home for their anti-union campaign. And incidentally, the website also prominently links to the National Right to Work Foundation, you know, one of the big anti-union organizations that's a national group. But so, yeah, they really, you know, view auto worker unionization as a real threat. And Kay Ivey, you can't talk about the Business Council of Alabama's anti-union efforts without talking about Kay Ivey, the governor, and really their ironclad alliance with Ivey. She's been the governor since 2017. She's very conservative, very pro-business. She's technically an elected official, but she basically functions as an arm of the Business Council of Alabama. And there are different ways to sort of measure this. I mean, one is looking at campaign finance. The Business Council of Alabama itself, as well as core members that lead the association, really dominate in terms of campaign donations to Ivey. So, for example, I counted that 7 of the top 12 donors to Ivey in the last election cycle in 2021-22 were either the Business Council of Alabama or top officers and board members. They're all giving her hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? I mean, it's a lot of money. But even more than that, I mean, there's a real stark revolving door that I found really kind of stunning, even for, you know, as someone who's looked at this stuff a lot. For example, her current director of legislative affairs is the former vice president of government affairs of the Business Council of Alabama, so he was a lobbyist for them. One of her two deputy chiefs of staff is the former director of the Business Council of Alabama's political action committee called Progress PAC. So, I mean, he was literally running the BCA's operation that was funneling corporate cash to Ivey's campaign and then jumps right into her administration into a top position. So it's really egregious. Her former communications director was a top staffer within the Business Council of Alabama. So, you know, it's a really sort of stark revolving door that you have between Ivey's administration and, you know, the heights of corporate power in Alabama. I should also say that, you know, it goes wider than Ivey. So, for example, the former Alabama Senate Majority Leader, you know, the top leader in the Alabama Senate, his name is Clay Schofield, and he stepped down last year towards the end of 2023. Why did he step down? To become the executive vice president of the Business Council of Alabama. So there's just really, you know, a lot of back and forth going on here between this corporate lobby group and the heights of power in Alabama.
I'm speaking with the writer and researcher, Derek Seidman. As I recall, when the southern states were luring auto plants, they were basically giving them enough subsidies to pay for the plants. But on top of that, you know, I'm sure they promised, we don't like unions down here, don't have to worry about unions. So it must be really, really quite the disappointment to the political class of a place like Alabama to see unions on the march in a part of the country when they were not supposed to be.
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that's striking to me about this pushback is that on the surface, in the manufacturing plants and so on, you have the auto companies that are leading the anti-union efforts there. But, you know, if you look at who's really behind these statewide efforts, it really is the heights of the ruling class in Alabama. So, for example, you know, the chairman of the Business Council of Alabama, his name is John Turner. He's the CEO of Regions Bank. It's the biggest bank in Alabama. And, you know, this is a guy who's taken in nearly $40 million over the past 3 years. these are the sort of people that are leading the campaign and telling auto workers that, you know, they can't even have a union. Interestingly enough, the most powerful force within the Business Council of Alabama is the electric utility, Alabama Power, which is, I think, widely seen in the state as the most powerful corporation in the state. It's a subsidiary of Southern Power, you know, one of the real utility powerhouses in the U.S. And if you look at the very top leadership of the Business Council of Alabama, more than a quarter of its officers and executive committee members are in some way connected to Alabama Power. The CEO, or they're also board members of Alabama Power. And what's interesting to me is that Alabama Power has been tied to all sorts of controversies and scandals. You know, they run the dirtiest power plant in the entire United States. But Alabama has some of the highest electric bills in the United States. You know, according to one report, it's like the second or third highest electric bills in the U.S., and they've completely captured the regulatory agencies. So you have a situation where this powerful corporation is dominating this group that's trying to stop the very workers from unionizing that are, you know, paying some of the highest electric bills in the United States. You have this kind of circular thing going on in terms of how corporate power is really impacting the lives of ordinary Alabamians in every kind of way.
Alabama Power, indeed. They have a news outlet, if you want to call it that, Yellowhammer, which sounds vaguely countercultural. What's the story of Yellowhammer? Who's behind it?
This is really interesting. It's one of the most, you know, I don't know, I guess I would call it stunning things that I came across. Yellowhammer, it's a conservative media outlet, and I use media in quotes for reasons that you'll understand in a second. You know, it's been very steadily, consistently attacking the UAW, and it's actually owned by a consultant who works for the Business Council of Alabama. Now, you wouldn't know this, you know, anywhere. It's not disclosed anywhere. My interest was sparked in Yellowhammer because Kay Ivey referenced it in a tweet a couple weeks ago where, you know, she referred to the UAW, I think, as a leech. She was citing Yellowhammer News. So I started digging into, you know, what is this Yellowhammer News? And, you know, there's been a lot of reporting on it within Alabama itself, but it's not really something that people outside of Alabama know too much about. It's one of those sort of websites, that media outlets, that's filled local media voids as newsrooms are being defunded and shut down. It was started in 2011 by a guy who would actually go on to join the Trump administration. And for a couple of years, it was not known that it was actually owned by two lobbyists who were deeply embedded in conservative politics in Alabama. Both of them were former executive directors of the Alabama Republican Party. And it wasn't known that they were benefactors of Yellowhammer until an independent investigative reporter named Eddie Curran in Alabama actually leaked an email that showed the CEO of Yellowhammer basically taking marching orders from one of these lobbyists about something that they were putting up about coal, right? The way that Eddie Curran described Yellowhammer to me when I talked to him, he said, the conservative politics are really just sort of the bait. It's really a kind of pay-per-play operation. You do business with these lobbyists and your interests are shown in a positive light within Yellowhammer. It's a popular media outlet. It has a pretty strong reach. And just to fast forward, late last year in fall 2023, it was announced that a political consultant named Paul Shashi was buying Yellowhammer. So he became the new owner. He was a kind of up-and-coming, you know, influential consultant. He actually managed both the Senate campaigns of Tommy Tuberville and Katie Britt. He is a principal in a communications firm that does business with really the heights of government in Alabama. But what was less known was that a few months earlier, the Business Council of Alabama had announced that they were hiring him as a political strategist. So basically, all this comes back to this situation right now where you have so-called media, Yellowhammer, every few days publishing something that's just ripping on the UAW, and it's actually owned by a political strategist who works for the Business Council of Alabama, who's leading the anti-union campaign throughout the state. And of course, none of this is disclosed in any of the coverage, right? So it really is a kind of cesspool.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, when one does media analysis, for example, and there's an analysis of power structures, there's usually some degree of professional and personal separation between the players in these different fields. It's of one piece in Alabama, it sounds like.
Yeah, and you know, I reached out to Shashi, I reached out to Yellowhammer News, I reached out to the Business Council of Alabama to ask them for comment. I wanted to know, ask Yellowhammer News what was their policy on disclosing conflicts, and they never got back to me. It's pretty clear to me that it's not something that they really care about too much. It doesn't appear that they're trying to be, even though they say on their page that they try to provide, quote, trustworthy content, they're really part of this larger operation within Alabama that is serving and pushing corporate interests.
Finally, if the unions have a victory, it would be a great victory for the workers involved, but also it would be really a serious blow to an entire ruling class of Alabama, right? This is not just about a union struggle at one particular plant.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, ultimately, while the union drive in Alabama is just that, it's a union drive, right? At the Mercedes-Benz plant. I really do think it represents something much bigger. It's an effort really to break the back of unchallenged corporate power in that state. It's really taking on a larger corporate power structure in that state that has been more or less unchallenged for a long time. And, you know, when we talk about Alabama, we're talking about one of the poorest states in the U.S. And I think that a successful UAW victory in Alabama, as well as in other states throughout the South, would really create a sort of opening to start to challenge this entrenched corporate power that has really held people down for so long in those states. So I think it would be hugely significant if the UAW wins this.
That was Derek Seidman, a researcher and writer who contributes regularly to Little Sis, a group that studies networks of power, and to Truthout. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Lynyrd Skynyrd's Sweet Home Alabama, a catchy, if deeply reactionary song, though some fans argue it's more complicated than that. But recall my exchange with Quint Slobodian about how reactionaries package over-the-top sentiments. In any case, I extracted a non-reactionary bit. By the way, none of the band members was from Alabama. Till next week, bye.